Good morning, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news and healthcare politics, debates, dialogues, discussions, a little bit of science, and answers to your questions via email or live on the air here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. I want to just let you know that next week we're going to be doing something special on healthcare reform and single payer. So those of you who have health questions, this would be the good week to do it since I won't be here live next week to answer them. So if you're a procrastinator, this is your moment to get off the dime, so to speak. Where does that expression come from? And I wanted to start by getting back to a topic that was raised by a caller a couple of weeks ago who wanted to know what I knew about IV immunoglobulin, or IVIG, for the treatment of diabetic neuropathy. And at the time, the answer was not much. Well, now I know a little bit more, so I want to talk about that. IV immunoglobulin is basically a blood product. It's manufactured from pool to plasma, so it's like getting a transfusion. And, you know, there's a certain amount of risk with that, which you don't want to just get a transfusion every day for fun. But taking aside the risks of becoming infected with something, which is very small, the therapy has been used for multiple sclerosis. It's been used for some other autoimmune diseases. And the concept is to modulate autoimmune diseases. And so I was kind of taken aback at diabetic neuropathy. But on reading the research, it has a place maybe in the treatment of a certain subtype of diabetic neuropathy, which is an autoimmune motor neuropathy. So for those of you out there with sensory neuropathy, which is the more typical diabetic neuropathy where you have burning and tingling and loss of sensation in the feet, this therapy is not going to work because that's not an autoimmune disease. On the other hand, if people have a motor neuropathies with a particular signature on EMG, on nerve conduction testing, then you can, in fact, help some people with IVIG. So it's a very small subgroup, maybe 1 or 2% of diabetics with neuropathy who might be helped by intravenous immunoglobulin. It doesn't generalize to the greater group. Sorry about that. I wish it were true. Some interesting short news articles, a couple of things about obstetrics and gynecology that I wanted to share with you. First of all, just out, a study looking at 3,500 women showed that taking a folic acid supplement for a year before conception reduced the risk of premature birth by over 50%. Now, that's a lot. That's a big number. And we've known for a long time that folic acid helps reduce neural tube deficits. And we've also known that you really need to be on the folic acid before you conceive to get the full benefit for that. This is the first study that I know of that's looked that far back before conception to see what benefits might accrue. And a 50% reduction in premature birth is a huge financial savings. So basically, any woman out there who's listening to this show who is not actively avoiding pregnancy should be taking 400 micrograms of folic acid supplementation every day. Most multivitamins have that. It's not that hard to find. Our diets are fairly low in America in folic acid. Very few of us get enough folate from our diets. So 400 micrograms is the dose, and you might even want to take twice that much for various reasons. But in terms of the science, 400 does the trick. And a 50% reduction in preterm labor, that's pretty important. Now, more about OB. Study supports breastfeeding. This is interesting. Women who breastfed for more than a year in their entire lifetimes had a 10% decrease lifelong of a stroke or a heart attack after menopause. They were also less likely to have diabetes, hypertension, and high cholesterol. And you'd say, well, maybe that's because women who breastfed for a whole year were very dedicated to their health. And, you know, that's a selection bias, because people who are more dedicated to health are going to have lower rates. But the study showed that even women who breastfed for just a month had distinctly lower rates of diabetes, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol compared to women who had never breastfed at all. It was a big study, 139,000 women, and it takes a big study to tease out little results like this. So I am intrigued and interested in that and looking forward to hearing more about what the long-term benefits of breastfeeding are. Because, you know what, maybe we should be facilitating breastfeeding, making it easier for women to breastfeed. Maybe we should value that instead of looking at it with resentment because it cuts into productivity in the workplace. Just a thought. Speaking of productivity in the workplace, just one other little study. This study looked at 17,000 Canadians aged 18 to 90, followed them for 12 years, and they were a part of something called the 1981 Canada Fitness Survey. And at that time, they were asked to rate how long each day they spent sitting, from almost none of the time to almost all of the time. It's probably one of those 5-point circle one kinds of responses. Anyway, looking at death and physical problems that occurred over the following 12 years, the researchers found a strong association between sitting time and mortality. Now, this, unfortunately, was not prevented by doing exercise on the weekends. So even people who exercised 2 or 3 hours a week but sat most of the weekday were not protected entirely from the dangers of sitting. Increased sitting time correlates with death rates from all causes except cancer, which is kind of odd, and you aren't protected by exercise. Bottom line, maybe we need to put treadmills in the break rooms in offices. Maybe we need to walk to work, park our cars 2 or 3 blocks away so that we get some walking time in on a daily basis. And of course, for people like myself, for nurses, for waiters, waitresses, flight attendants, people who do spend most of their workday on their feet, woohoo, we may be getting something back, mortality-wise, in return for those sore feet and bunions. Let's talk to Roz in Carmel. Hello, Roz, and welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering, is it possible to rebuild bones if you have osteoporosis from taking medications such as Femara for breast cancer?
Okay, very good question. And the answer is yes, it is possible to rebuild bones. And the thing to understand about rebuilding bones is that you actually can get substantial benefit before it shows up on one of our DEXA or bone mass scans. So while the scans are useful, we see a lot of benefit from some of the bone rebuilding therapies. And what are those? Well, for one thing, weight-bearing exercise, right? Vitamin D at relatively high doses and calcium are all important. You need the raw materials, and vitamin D helps you absorb calcium. So all of those have to be present at the appropriate amounts. Then you need the stimulus, which could be weight-bearing exercise, and you need to have the ratio of osteoclasts, which are the bone breakdown cells, and osteoblasts working well. In people who are severely impaired, who have lost a lot of bone and who are at risk for fracture, particularly if it's a drug-induced thing like being on steroids or being on a hormone blocker, as you suggested, I am really liking a new drug called Forteo. And Forteo is a synthetic form of parathyroid hormone, and it is very helpful in building bone. It's given by injection, and it is expensive. So only people who are pretty severely impaired are able to get this drug right now. But I anticipate that you might qualify. You've got to have a lot of diagnoses, and it helps to be Medicare age. But if you've had a breast cancer diagnosis and you've got frank osteoporosis, with some finagling, you can probably get a hold of that drug. And rather than using a bisphosphonate or an estrogen analog, if the osteoporosis is severe and drug-induced like that, I like the strategy of rebuilding the bone using the Forteo for perhaps a year, and then at that point doing something to stabilize the bone. Now, even a person with breast cancer could take Evista, which is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, which basically is longhand for it acts like estrogen on the bones, and that will not interfere with the anti-metabolite effects even of ongoing breast cancer treatment with a drug like Femara.
Mm-hmm. How about Actonal?
Actonal is a bisphosphonate, and the way these drugs work is by altering the character of the bone so that it can't be broken down by the osteoclasts as rapidly. So it slows bone breakdown. It doesn't speed up bone buildup.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in general, what we see with drugs with the bisphosphonates is we see a decrease in future fractures, and that happens fairly rapidly because the bone isn't being broken down faster than it's being built up. So it's got a benefit. But it's rare to see significant increases in bone density. So it really depends on how bad off you are, whether you go to just preserving the bone you've got and slowing its breakdown, or whether you actually actively try to stimulate new bone deposition.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on how bad off you are.
Okay. Have you heard of a product called strontium?
Yes, and thank you for asking about that. Strontium is a mineral, basically. It's on the periodic table of the elements, and it stabilizes bone. Most of the studies in strontium use a form of strontium, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the salt, but it's actually not available in the United States. So the best studies were using a different form of strontium than the one we use here, which is a weakness of the situation because we don't have clear data that the strontium salt that we're using here works. But there's reason to believe that it does. Other things that can help with slowing bone breakdown and helping stabilize bone are boron and vitamin K. And as I mentioned, vitamin D. I had an email here from Maria in Carmel who has osteoporosis because she had taken Advair for asthma, and she's wondering what sort of treatment to take. And she has a history of esophageal reflux, which is heartburn. And I tend to view that as a really good reason not to take a bisphosphonate because these drugs are very irritating to the esophagus. So if you do have any heartburn tendency, there's definitely going to be a tendency for you to hurt yourself using these drugs. So I would tend to steer a person with heartburn towards the selective estrogen receptor modulator, the Evista. In the case of Maria, she's got a T-score of about a -2, which is early osteoporosis, not severe. Do you know your T-score, Roz?
You know, I don't. I don't have my paperwork in front of me. I'm sure it must be on bone density test?
Yeah, and a T-score of, say, 2.0 is borderline osteoporosis. We call it osteopenia. Increased fracture risk, but not likely to break a bone just from standing up or twisting or coughing. When you get into a T-score of like 4.5, that's a situation where a person could just get a cold and cough hard and break a vertebrae. Uh-huh. Just from coughing. And anyone who's had a fracture, like a collapsed fracture of the vertebrae, even if their T-score is only 2.5 or 2.6, probably needs to think about this injectable drug, because there you're looking at something else going on besides bone density. You've got bad bone structure. You've got some other factor that we aren't able to measure. That's another thing also for family history. So T-score is not everything. If you've got a family history of lots of fractures or you've broken something, particularly a vertebral fracture, even if your T-score is not terrible, you probably have very weak bones and should be being very aggressive trying to protect them. It's a complicated subject, so I hope that's helped.
I love your show. Thank you
very much. Let's see, we had an off-air comment about Reclast in your earlier discussions of osteoporosis. What do I think of it? Well, Reclast is a bisphosphonate, and it's a once-a-year shot. I think it's more dangerous than the pills because I am concerned about jaw osteonecrosis when you give a massive dose of something like this and you happen to have an apical abscess at the bottom of a tooth that you don't know about. You might end up with a large amount of decay and bacterial infection in your jaw. And even though that's a rare complication as far as we know, we're not exactly going around and doing MRIs on everybody's jaws. So I think the bisphosphonates in concentrated once-a-year doses should be reserved for people who have cancer or Paget's disease of the bone or something where they really need to take that risk. I don't think convenience is a good reason. got to answer an email here real quick from Shaul in Israel. Shaul is a regular emailer and recently sent this one. My eye doctor told me I have blepharitis. He suggested to put chamomile tea in my eye for at least half an hour a day forever. It's hard to implement. Any other solution? I love the chamomile tea idea. It's great. And of course, because it's hard to do, if it doesn't work, then you can say, well, you didn't do it right. I have a really good solution for blepharitis that has so far worked on everybody, which is baby shampoo. One takes baby shampoo, puts it on a soft washcloth, and rubs it along the base of the eyelashes every day, then rinses the eyes carefully to rinse off all the shampoo. And that has cleared every case of blepharitis that I've ever treated. So that's my solution for you, Shaul. And thanks for asking a question I could answer. One more quick email. This is from Tom in St. Louis. And Tom wants to know what he should weigh. If I look at a BMI chart, it says I could be anywhere from 19 to 25, and I know I could attain either one, although getting to 25 might be more fun. How do I know what is the best weight for me? Do I use an objective standard like cholesterol or the amount of old clothes in the closet or something more subjective like if I feel good? Well, Tom, the BMI, it isn't a prescriptive number quite the way you're thinking of it. You can think of it as a statistical risk factor. So it's about survival. And when you have your BMI between 19 and 25, there is essentially no measurable statistical hit from the weight that you're taking. You don't have an increased risk of death relative to either end. You have a decreased risk of death or disability. When you get below 19, statistically, large group analysis, you have an increased risk. And part of that may just be because when you get sick, you don't have any fat to live off of, and so you melt your muscles and get weak. Certainly that's the case with many elders who have a BMI below 19. It isn't always healthy to be less. In the case of higher BMIs, when you get above 25, we start to see increases in hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, all the bad stuff. So we know that too much of a good thing is a bad thing. Within that range, I would say the weight and BMI that is easiest and most comfortable for you to maintain, stability is probably the key indication of what your own biological set point is. I think consistency is important. Going up and down, even within that 19 to 25 range, has got to be more of a stress to your body than maintaining a stable weight. Stability is generally good. So I think whatever you can maintain with a moderate amount of exercise and a moderate diet is where you should be. Let's go now to Barbara in Freedom. Hello, Barbara, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. I appreciate your show very much, and I have a zillion questions, but the one I was going to focus today was that I've been experiencing a kind of mini health renaissance since eliminating gluten from my diet.
A mini health renaissance. In other words, you're feeling better.
I'm feeling better.
Okay.
Yes, and at first I thought that maybe, you know, it was a diet fad because, you know, everything's gluten-free. But then I heard your interview with Dr. Hyman, who explained that our U.S. wheat varieties are even stickier than European gliadins, mm-hmm. I think it's called.
Right.
So I was curious about gluten intolerance and genetic components. Does it evolve into an autoimmune? And how much do you all know about the mapping of the intestine absorption of nutrients?
All right. Well, actually, I probably know a fair amount about this, so let me try to frame a good, not too long-winded response to your question.
Okay.
First of all, there's gluten sensitivity, and then there's celiac disease.
Okay.
And it's important to distinguish between the two, because people can be sensitive to gluten and not have celiac disease. And this is a very important distinction to make. Celiac disease is where you actually have an autoimmune attack on the small bowel, on the intestinal wall. And that autoimmune attack destroys the villi. The absorptive surface of the small bowel is reduced, and you're unable to get your vitamins in because you don't have the surface area to absorb them. This is very bad. Celiac sprue, which is celiac disease, is diagnosed by biopsy, and you see certain changes in the small bowel. And these people often have weight loss and severe diarrhea. And they all, to a person, will have a certain HLA antigen on the surface of their cells they'll either have DR2 or DR8.
DR2 or DR8.
And you can test for DR2 or DR8, but it might be worth doing to refute a diagnosis of celiac disease. But since it's a biopsy-proven diagnosis, we don't really ever bother to do that. I can think of circumstances where maybe you'd want to test it, but it's not relevant to the discussion. So there are people who have reactivity, antibodies against gliadin, which is a breakdown product of gluten. And there are people who just have allergies to gliadin. And so they'll have antibodies, but they won't necessarily have the autoimmune attack on their intestinal wall. Now, these people can be said to have gluten sensitivity, and they will manifest sometimes with symptoms in the intestines, such as bloating, pain, irritable bowel-like symptoms. And in fact, parenthetically, when I have a patient with irritable bowel, I take them off corn, I take them off wheat, I take them off dairy, and a lot of them get miraculously better just by removing those things from the diet. And then we play around with some acupuncture and we add foods back and we try to find tolerance levels. But it's amazing how much irritable bowel disease is really just food sensitivity. And it always should be addressed that way. I'm convinced of that now. With respect to gluten itself, it's important to understand that this is a new disease, and it's a disease because of alterations that have been made in the food supply, as Dr. Hyman discussed. So the opportunity to develop gluten sensitivity wasn't present 50 years ago because we weren't being exposed to massive quantities of gluten in this highly processed form in our diet. So it's a matter of, if you grow up in a house with 20 cats, you're much more likely to be allergic to cats. Volume of exposure is very important in the development of allergies. And there are many other factors involved, you know, the use of antibiotics in childhood that influence the development of the bowel flora. We're a big ecology. I was listening to a talk about the carbon cycle last night when I was driving home, and they were talking about carbon and carbon in cement and how that contributes to global warming. And I was thinking about my own body and all of these interacting things and the flora in my gut and the antibodies and the leukotrienes and all these signals. And I'm thinking my own internal ecology is a planet worth of complexity right there. Yeah. And here I am, you know, the poor ecologist. I'm the body ecologist as a doctor, you know, trying to sort through this. The bottom line as a scientist looking at ecology is you want a lot of different things balancing each other. And when you get too much of any one thing, it's likely to be bad. And that's just a real rule of dynamic systems. And we are a dynamic system. So I'm pleased that you're feeling better. And I wanted to mention other symptoms that improve when people go on a gluten-free diet can include things like arthritis, rashes, itching, itching in the mouth, itching in the nose, congestion, sometimes asthma, all sorts of things that just seem to be occurring so far from the intestine that you don't even understand why it would be. But it's because these antibodies attach to the gliadin molecule, and that forms an immune complex. Anytime you have antibodies that grab onto something, that creates a complex that has to be eliminated by the body. And one of the things that happens is that those complexes get trapped in capillary beds. And so they'll get trapped in the capillary beds of the joints, trapped in the capillary beds of the skin. And so wherever you have a lot of capillaries, the immune complexes can accumulate, and they will cause the release of inflammatory molecules, leukotrienes, prostaglandins, and you end up with this little local immune cascade that's actually generated from absorbing an antigen across the intestinal wall. It is really true. It sounds like a health fad, and you know, we've seen so many of them, but this one has really good data, and we have objective testing that we can do. We can measure these antibodies in your bloodstream. So it's a real thing. And one more weirdness about it is that some of the breakdown products of glutens are called gluteomorphins, and they actually look like opiates in terms of their affinity structurally, and they will circulate in the bloodstream and go to the brain and actually mess up your brain. Yeah, it's like you're drugged. It's like you're stoned off of the gluten. So, I mean, it's so bizarre, and it does seem rather far-fetched, but these things can all be measured. There's objective science that supports this. It's really not just another health food fad.
Just an interesting thing that you mentioned, I did take antibiotics for a year when I was 6 years old because of scarlet fever, and then 4 strep throat. So.
What I would suggest for you, just parenthetically, Barbara, is since you've identified that you have issues with gluten, I would stay away from gluten for at least a year, and meanwhile, take lots and lots of probiotics and prebiotics. Really try to repopulate the ground cover in your intestines. And there's a good show in the archives about probiotics and prebiotics. It's Dr. Gary Hufnagel. But this show gives you prescriptive information about how much probiotics and how to use it. And I think if you fix your gut flora, then after a year, you'll probably be able to tolerate small amounts of gluten. Unless you're truly celiac positive, in which case, don't go there. But if you test negative on the tissue transglutaminase antibodies, then go ahead, fix the gut, fix the absorptive surface, and then see if you can tolerate small amounts.
And have a pastry once in a while.
Yeah, a pastry, and you don't have to worry if you eat lunch meat that has gluten in it, or you get some soy sauce that has gluten in it. People who are really high celiac disease, have such a restricted diet. I mean, salad dressings, they really have to be careful. And it's sad because we shouldn't have to restrict ourselves that much. So not a fun disease to have. The date on that was June 9th, 2007. And you can go to Ask Dr. Dawn and look in the archives, and that'll give you the information on the probiotics.
Terrific.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Someone called in and said that you can get gluten-free pretzels at the Marina Grocery Outlet. I still am not in favor of gluten-free pretzels, but if you've really, really got a carb, Jones, I guess once in a while, I'd have to let you have a treat. And let's go to our next caller, which is Christopher in Santa Cruz. Hello, Christopher, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
My call. Love your show.
Thank you.
My question ties in just with your last caller. I got diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 6 years ago. And have been relatively non-acute, although once in a while I'll come down either with an infection or I'll eat some bad food and get food poisoning, and it'll send me into just a ramping 2 week to 1 month long acute episode. So my question is, how do you feel about the drug therapy 6-MP, and do you think it's a valid way to sort of stave off those once in a while acute flare-ups?
Okay, well, I don't think that heavy immune suppressant drugs are a good long-term solution for inflammatory bowel disease. I believe their place is in putting out the fire when you have an acute flare-up, but I don't like to see them used preventatively, because while they are effective at prevention, they are an immune suppressant, and suppressing the immune system non-selectively across the board is taking a substantial risk with your patient, and it shouldn't be done lightly, and if there's another solution or another strategy, that should be taken first. There's a lot of data on Crohn's disease looking at preventing outbreaks and what sorts of products, particularly nutritional and herbal products, that might be beneficial. And there's good data on a number of things. Coming up in a couple of weeks, probably June 13th, is an interview with Gerard Mullen, who's an expert on inflammatory bowel disease. So this will be discussed at great length, and if you missed the show, you might want to watch for the podcast. But just to briefly recap what he said in that interview, there's very, very good evidence that probiotics are helpful in preventing flare-ups and reducing the flare-ups of Crohn's disease. There's a strong basis for the idea that you want to reestablish a anti-inflammatory bowel flora. As you said, whenever something happens that upsets your immune system, that activates your immune system, it triggers an attack. Effectively, what's wrong with your gut is that when the immune system gets turned on, it takes no prisoners. It's, we destroyed the village in order to save it kind of mentality. And so your immune system attacks your own intestines. What we want is, we don't want the immune system to be turned on in the first place. So avoiding triggers and trying to modulate the immune system without using outright immune suppressants. What you want to do is you want to use upregulator prevention, but you don't want to suppress the immune system completely, so you are able to fight off infections in the other parts of your body. So what things to use? I mentioned the probiotics. Another really important thing, there are some herbs. Quercetin has good data. Quercetin. Boswellia is another anti-inflammatory, and turmeric, or the active ingredient, which is curcuminoids, also very helpful. And the doses are actually in that interview. I don't off the top of my head remember them, but that information will be coming up. If you need to use something because that's not sufficient, I prefer to see people using mesalamine or one of the non-steroidals, which are non-absorbable, and they do have a downside because they increase intestinal permeability, which is not good for the immune system because it allows it to be exposed to more antigens. But if you can't suppress the inflammation with the kinder, gentler herbal substances plus the appropriate probiotics, then using a local mesalamine or a local anti-inflammatory makes a lot more sense because its effect remains in the gut, as opposed to 6-mercaptopurine or infliximab or some of the other drugs that are being used for this, which suppress the immune system as a whole. I believe those should be used to get people out of an acute attack and then discontinued. I think it's much, much better not to suppress the immune system across the board for a long time. I worry about long-term cancer. I'm worrying about people showing up after 10 years of doing this with lymphoma. And it's like, oh, oops, well, we kept you from having Crohn's attack, but we gave you lymphoma. And, you know, it'll take 10 years for us to figure out what the risk is.
I just hear testimonials of doctors having patients on it for 30 years without side effects, but I know that they exist. So
For 30 years for 6-mercaptopurine?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there are, but because that drug's been around for a very, very long time. But what percentage of those people got cancer? And is it higher than the percentage of people that would get cancer, you know, in the general population? That's not going to be counted as a side effect, is it? That's a whole different disease. Lymphoma? Yeah. What does that have to do with Crohn's disease?
Yeah, well, thanks, and I'll look forward to the June 13th update. I appreciate that. Oh, and last thing, is there any new evidence of what doctors in Europe are doing compared to the standard GI practice in the United States?
I'm sure there is, but I'm not familiar with the literature on that.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Randall in SoCal. Hello, Randall. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am 56 years old, and just in the last couple of years, I've become allergic to bee stings or wasp stings and poison oak. And I was wondering if there's anything I can do to get my immunity back.
Okay. So poison oak... Have you lived in an area all your life that has poison oak and you just recently begun to react to it?
I'm from Louisiana, and there we have poison ivy. I've never been allergic to poison ivy, and when I moved to Santa Cruz 29 years ago, I never got poison oak, even though I've walked through an area or worked with it. And
now you're reacting. So,
yes.
And the Hymenoptera, I'm sure you had bee stings in childhood and...
Yes.
Didn't react, and now are you getting to the point where you have to carry an EpiPen or epinephrine, or is it just a really bad localized reaction, or are you getting hives from the bee sting?
Very bad local reaction, very intense swelling, and my doctor has recommended that I carry an injectable.
Mm-hmm. But you've never actually gotten hives or had wheezing from a bee sting?
No.
Okay. Very important distinction. Because the anaphylactic reaction is body-wide, and it's caused by the release of histamine from mast cells in your general circulation and in your lungs and in your skin, and that's why the hives and the wheezing. If you get a body-wide reaction, that's a different branch of the immune system. That's the Th2 hypersensitivity allergic branch.
Mm-hmm.
Poison oak is a Th1 reaction, and so is the local swelling and inflammation of a bee sting. And the reason that's an important distinction is it tells us which of the two systems is upregulated. And we had a caller a few minutes ago who has Crohn's disease. Crohn's disease, by the way, is a Th1 related autoimmune disease, as is rheumatoid arthritis. And so the reason this is important is that we know enough about the biochemistry now that we know which signals are activated in Th1 versus Th2. And someday, very soon, we'll probably be able to selectively block with probably pharmaceuticals or very, very highly extracted herbal substances. We'll be able to selectively block upregulated Th1 versus upregulated Th2. Okay, enough science. Practically speaking, slow desensitization would probably help for the poison oak. that used to be available that you could buy injectable poison oak extract, and you would gradually give people higher and higher concentrations of that in their skin. You'd give them a sub-Q injection, and they would down-regulate their immune system, down-regulate their TH1, and they'd become less and less sensitive. That was one of the products that got removed by the FDA because it was an old product and had never done any science, and it wasn't, basically, it didn't have a big enough market to make it sense for the company to do the science. So that went away about 15 years ago. There are homeopathic versions of the toxin, the Bruce toxidendron, and oddly enough, they seem to help a lot of people. So I would look into the homeopathic solutions for your poison oak. It may be possible that you can induce a sort of desensitization by eating a small amount of the poison oak. Oral desensitization protocols are out there. I'm sure you can find something on the internet. I've always been too nervous about getting an itchy butt, you know, and get in eating too much and then getting poison oak outbreak at the anus to be willing to try that one myself. But so, you know, you're forewarned here. Those are strategies that you could use.
I have a friend who does regularly eat poison oak, and he's never had a rash.
Yeah.
But I'm a little worried that having gotten poison oak rashes recently to eat it now.
Well, I understand. Most of the desensitization protocols would start off with eating like a square millimeter, a tiny little fragment of the leaf, and then the next day eating a little bit more. And so very, very gradual increased exposures. And presumably what we're doing is invoking, somehow creating a tolerance to the molecule. And I wouldn't try this if you have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis or some condition where your immune system is out of whack, because you might end up having a very bad effect. But we seem to be able to teach our body to accept substances that it's become allergic to by showing it very small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
And this tolerance is, the mechanisms of it are not understood, but it has to do with the fact that our cells can actually learn things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we teach our cells by doing this not to react. With respect to why you're doing this now, I think it's stress. Probably some kind of physiological or psychological stress has caused your immune system to be a little bit more vigilant at this point in your life. So you've fixed upon these antigens as bad things. And you've mistakenly learned, your immune system has mistakenly learned to attack these. And that generally happens during a period of physiological stress where the immune system gets upregulated and it's looking for something to kill. Just like, I have all these war metaphors running through my heads, you know, the special ops guys going through a valley in Afghanistan and they're on a hair trigger and, you know, somebody pokes their head out between two rocks and it's like 15 machine guns, boom, 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 boom. And if your immune system is in that kind of a mood, and a little harmless poison oak antigen comes along, well, guess what? You're going to now react to poison oak.
Mm. And what about insect stings?
Same sort of thing, I think. You're having a TH1 type reaction. It's not going to be, not anaphylaxis. You know, it's okay to carry an EpiPen, but it won't probably reduce the amount of swelling and pain you get when you get stung. On the other hand, until you have hives or wheezing, I'm not so worried that you're going to die.
Is there a homeopathic formula I could take to build my immune system to insect stings?
There is. I am not a homeopathist, though, and I recommend that you see someone who's a certified homeopathist.
Okay.
And not just go to the health food store and buy stuff.
Okay.
Okay? I would definitely go there if you're really serious about trying to downregulate. I think homeopathy is promising.
All right.
And I want to emphasize, I have no scientific data. This is purely experiential, anecdotal.
All right.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much, Dr. Don.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Mead in Watsonville. Hello, Mead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a suggestion for the person who was inquiring about poison oak and how to desensitize.
Oh, go ahead.
You can buy poison oak honey, which might be a good first step rather than going right straight into chewing up the poison oak.
Uh-huh.
It's available at like some of the farmers markets and things like that.
Oh, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Good to know. Yeah, poison oak honey. I've got a lot of poison oak on my hill, and I'm just thinking about the size of those flowers. I'm wondering how on earth they managed to get enough pollen to make honey with it.
They do, briefly, and there is flowers on them. I haven't really experimented with this, but I've been told that there is some effectiveness in it. So
it's certainly worth a try. Obviously, nobody's assaying it for poison oak fragments, and it could be inconsistent in the dosing.
but fairly benign thing. Thanks very much for the suggestion.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're going to Jane in Carmel. Hello, Jane, and welcome to the program.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Over the past couple of years, I've experienced vertigo several times, and it's getting to be almost back-to-back. You know, I'll get it, and then it'll last sometimes for a few days, and or sometimes a little longer, and I'll do the Epley maneuver, or whatever they call that,
mm-hmm.
several times, and sometimes that clears it up. I have asked my doctor about it. He said, oh, maybe you have a virus in your ear. I mean, he's, and then at one point he gave me this medication. It was like a motion sickness medication, which made me feel just awful.
Right.
I had it for a long time, the last time, about 3 weeks. Then it went away, and I took a trip recently, a business trip, and I came back, and I had it again. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. So what do you think?
Well, the fact that you sometimes respond to the Epley maneuver is fairly diagnostic, that it's not a virus in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty much diagnostic of something called benign positional vertigo. And I want you to visualize a nautilus shell, okay? You know, the those curved shells that spiral in on themselves?
Right, right.
And I want you to make it into a snow globe, okay? So now you've got a nautilus shell. It's got thick liquid in it, and it's got little snow sparklies. And when you shake it, the snow sparklies dance around, and then eventually they settle down to the bottom of the spiral, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got your picture there?
Got it.
All right. Our inner ear has a balance organ that is three circles, like three donuts that are hollow and have the little sparkles in them and have the thick liquid. And when we move our head, the sparkles dance, and that is picked up by the nerves. And the nerves send a signal to the brain saying, your head just moved 45 degrees to the left, and now it's not moving anymore because the thick fluid stops the sparkles, and when the sparkles stop, then the brain knows that you stopped moving. Still with me? In benign positional vertigo, you've got sparkles that are not tethered. They are wandering around, and they keep moving. So they fool the brain into thinking that you're still moving. And that's why you feel like you're moving, because the brain is getting a signal from the motion sensor saying that it's moving, but that signal is a false alarm signal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason that the Epley maneuver works is, back to the nautilus shell, if you can imagine if you took that shell and you held it up so that all the sparkles went down the tube, and then you spun it a little bit so the sparkles went further down the tube, and then you spun it again so they went further down the tube. At the end, you could trap the sparkles at the very center of the nautilus shell.
Oh.
Okay? And then usually, because there's a little cup there, usually once you get them down there, they stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And in your case, when they come out, you get vertigo again.
Mm.
So you just keep doing the Epley maneuvers until you get it shoved back up into the little cupola. It's actually called a cupola. Until it shakes loose again, you're good. Eventually, it stops. Eventually, the body manages to get that thing solidly locked in to the little cupola, and the vertigo stops happening. But in the short run, things to avoid are bouncy things. So, you know, bouncy aerobics or running, because that will tend to shake loose the particles, and they haven't gotten fully fixed. And so when you move, like bend over and come back up again, you should do it kind of slowly. And remember Julie Andrews with the books on her head in that, I forget which movie that was. I think it was My Fair Lady. Anyway.
I'm just wondering if sometimes what I do when I wash my hair, I bend over like real fast, you know, and then dry.
Not a good idea. Yeah. Now that you understand the mechanism, you can sort of figure out what you should avoid doing.
Okay. That's great. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the advice.
It's unpleasant, but don't worry about it.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye.
And just parenthetically, I was taught about the viral infection, and that's what I thought it was for 10 years until this new hypothesis came out. And this new hypothesis has, well, for one thing, we've got MRIs now so we can visualize the structures. And for another, the Epley maneuver works. So we've got good data that supports the hypothesis. So I really do think this is what's going on. Let's go to Bill in Marina. Hello, Bill, and welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Love your show. I was on Wellbutrin and Effexor, not at the same time, but different times. And I think one of them affected my immune system. At the time that I was taking it, I had to stop taking it. I did not wean off.
Mm-hmm.
I think this was the Wellbutrin. And I had a horrible time. I got really sick.
Right.
And I couldn't get better and didn't know why. And I saw somebody and they said it was my immune system. They helped me get better. Years later, I haven't taken either. And I feel like my immune system's been compromised. Is it possible that something like that can hurt you in a, for a long-term period of time?
Well, the answer to an is it possible question is always going to be yes, because it's very hard. Impossible is not something that comes along very much occasionally, but it's not terribly plausible because of the mechanisms of the drug that that would be the case. One question or point I would like to make is that depression itself is a profound immune suppressant.
That's not something that I've had any issues with for a while.
Right. When you had the discontinuation syndrome, when you came off the Wellbutrin, the symptoms of that can make you feel like you've got a flu, a lot of fatigue, achiness, a lot of spinning, weird zings in the head, headaches. Coming off
extreme.
Of this drug can be pretty nasty.
I still get migraines.
Mm-hmm. I think it's possible that the drugs altered your body chemistry permanently, but I don't find it very plausible, and I wouldn't find it particularly useful in terms of what to do. You said someone was able to help your immune system. Was that with herbs or with...
Yeah, a lot of directions and schooling and really sticking to a specific diet.
Yeah.
I really need to stick to it.
I think you might need to stick to it because you have some kind of sensitivity, and when
I
you
feel
set up...
extremely sensitive. I get sick very easily. If I get a cold, I get a pneumonia.
Yeah. Check your red blood cell zinc. That's a blood test your regular doctor can order.
Okay.
And make sure that it's adequate, because low zinc is not uncommon, and it is a real issue for the immune system. So you might just be zinc deficient, and if that's the case, you would benefit a lot from zinc supplementation.
Would zinc affect migraines?
I'm not sure, but magnesium certainly would.
Okay.
So you could also get a red blood cell magnesium.
Okay.
Could be something as simple as mineral deficiencies.
Okay, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Margaret in Santa Cruz. Hello, Margaret. We've got just a couple of minutes, but
yes.
I wanted to get your call in.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm a 73-year-old healthy woman living in Santa Cruz. I've had insomnia for the last 5 years. It was initially triggered by depression. I went through various drugs, which didn't help. I had ECT, which did help. I no longer have depression, but I still have insomnia. My specific question is, and you may want to fill me in with additional info, one of my physicians is okay with my taking Ambien for sleep, and another physician does not want me to take Ambien at all because of the danger of, seeing things that aren't there.
Hallucinations.
Yes, thank you. Couldn't find the word. Okay.
Okay. Well, have you ever hallucinated on Ambien?
Oh, no.
Okay. And what dose have you been using?
What works well for me is I have 10 milligram tabs. Mm-hmm. If I break one in half, sometimes the 5 milligram will take me all the way through the night, and sometimes when I have to get up to void, I take the other 5 milligram, and then that takes me through the rest of the night appropriately.
Okay. This is a controversy in medicine about long-term use of Ambien, and there have been some really scary anecdotes about people waking up after Thanksgiving and lying on the floor in the kitchen with the entire turkey gone, like sleep eating, and people having sleep automatisms, they're called, where you do things in your sleep.
Driving.
Yeah, well, hopefully not, but yes, that's the kind of thing we're talking about. These were cases, anecdotal case reports, where that people had used Ambien and they'd had this weird reaction. That being said, I don't think that the across-the-board clinical data, and certainly not my clinical experience, supports the idea that Ambien is a bad drug.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's actually a pretty good sleeping aid. But I do worry, if one takes it every night, I do worry about people eventually becoming dependent on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so I have a little strategy that I swear by, and it makes me comfortable just writing Ambien indefinitely for people
mm-hmm.
and not worrying about their becoming dependent,
mm-hmm.
which is you take a drug holiday.
Mm-hmm.
I call it 3 nights on, 1 night off. Going through medical school, I was on every fourth night call a lot of the time. And sometimes every third night call. And I learned that you can go without sleep 25% of the time and do pretty well. So I have people take their Ambien for up to 3 days in a row and skip the fourth day And on the fourth day, if they want to use a different agent like 5-hydroxytryptophan or valerian, or getting into drugs, they wanted to use Benadryl, trazodone, which is an antidepressant, some other form of sedative that works on a different chemical pathway, then they can do that if they really can't tolerate that fourth night without anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that that's a very long-term sustainable strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone runs out of Ambien, they don't get rebound insomnia, which does happen if you take Ambien every day mm-hmm. for a long time, say a year.
Mm-hmm.
You may not sleep for 3 days at all when the Ambien's withdrawn.
Mm-hmm.
We've not seen people have seizures back with the Valium and stuff. When people would take Valium for sleeping,
mm-hmm.
when they withdrew, they would sometimes actually have seizures, which is mm-hmm. a terrible side effect.
Mm-hmm.
So does that help?
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. And I want to thank you all for listening. Thank you. Thank the callers for calling in. Thank the emailers for emailing in. Please check the website, askdrdon.com. We're working very hard to make that a health resource. The archives, I think, if I say so myself, are wonderful in terms of that. And we would welcome your comments as well as your questions. This is Dr. Don. With great thanks to my note clippers, Joe Tribulato and Duff Howell, and heartfelt thanks to my producer, Charles Mansky. Thanks to everyone here at KUSP Studios. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.